It is 8:30, and we have with us live in the studios once again, Jav Parrish, co-editor of Eat the State. Good morning.
Oh, good morning. Good morning to you.
Sorry to interrupt your morning read.
Yeah, well, you're my little alarm clock around 8:30 and on a Saturday morning. It's very nice.
Well, I'm hoping I'm...
You know, sleeping in the chair is really kind of uncomfortable. Not to mention that the overnight people don't appreciate it. But anyway.
We're just trying to make sure you're here. So, plenty to cover. Not a lot locally, but looks like the our judges have been fairly active this week in the state.
Yeah, we got a couple of initiatives overturned, both of them statewide. The good news is that I-747, Tim Eyman's 2001 property tax initiative that limited property taxes to 1% annual increases, well below the cost of inflation, unless approved by voters. That was overturned by King County Superior Court Judge Mary Roberts, using the rationale that Tim Eyman was deceptive in his presentation of the initiative, which, you know, Tim Eyman and deceptive in the same sentence has cropped up before from time to time. But Attorney General Rob McKenna has already said he will appeal it. It is kind of an interesting case because what happened is that 747 was based upon, in its language, a previous initiative, I-722, which had reduced property taxes to a 2% annual cap rather than 6% had originally been the case under state law. And that initiative had been found unconstitutional. However, it was found unconstitutional after the petitions had been circulated and signatures gathered, but before the initiative appeared on the ballot. So Eyman's argument on that is, well, he shouldn't be responsible for anticipating a court decision at the time that his his initiative was initially the language in it was crafted. So that will probably go on to the state Supreme Court, but for the time being, that is invalidated. The bad news, unfortunately, is that I-297, the 2004 initiative that barred further import of radioactive waste to the Hanford Nuclear Reservation unless the current waste was cleaned up first, which will happen, according to the current federal government timeline, approximately the time the sun goes supernova. You know, if not a couple of days after, or at least a few seconds after. But unfortunately, it got thrown out this week in its entirety. There was only a portion of it that was actually being appealed, but federal district court judge Alan McDonald threw the whole thing out, basically with the same rationale that some folks had a concern about when the initiative was first drafted, which is that the federal government, under a the legislation from I think 1954 that governs the jurisdiction over nuclear waste in the United States, that jurisdiction is given to the federal government. And it was the same issue that came up when Yucca Mountain was so fiercely opposed by Nevada, all of Nevada, the residents, the state legislature, the governor, the congressional legislation, state laws that were passed, everything to try and keep the Department of Energy from establishing the nation's permanent nuclear waste repository at Yucca Mountain. And they had a very good case against Yucca Mountain, among other things. It was located on an active earthquake fault, but it didn't matter. They took it to court, and the court sided with the federal government on that, and that is what has happened to the Hanford initiative as well, 297, now known as the I think Cleanup Priorities Act. Rob McKenna has not said whether he will appeal or not. So that may or may not be a final decision. We'll have to wait and see. And it's kind of revealing that McKenna, who is a Republican, rushed within 24 hours to appeal Tim Eyman's initiative. But for the Hanford initiative, which was sponsored by Heart of America Northwest and other progressive and anti-nuclear activists, and which passed with 70% of the vote, McKenna has not said whether he will appeal that or not. So maybe a few well-placed calls and emails to McKenna's office might help him make up his mind.
All right. Well, moving to national and sticking with the courts, it looks like they had a little knock-knock joke this week.
Yeah. Unfortunately, they didn't knock-knock at all, which is part of the joke. The U.S. Supreme Court ruled 5-4 with Bush appointees Alito and Roberts providing the key swing votes, more evidence the Democrats made a lifetime's worth of mistakes when they didn't seriously oppose those nominations. They ruled that police do not have to knock as long as they have a warrant before barging into somebody's private residence, that they can just come in. And, you know, how on earth is somebody supposed to know that if they're woken out of a deep sleep at 4 in the morning that somebody barging into their apartment isn't aren't the bad guys as opposed to law enforcement. It's really kind of a curious ruling. On the other hand, the Supreme Court had a good ruling, which got a lot less attention this week. It was contested, which says a lot about this country. It was a 5-3 ruling, but they did rule in favor of a Tennessee man who is on death row. And the case was whether an inmate on death row who has compelling evidence based on DNA evidence that he might be innocent, whether he has the right to appeal his conviction or not. With all of the laws that have been passed in recent years constricting, and court decisions, including this Supreme Court, constricting the right of particularly death row inmates to launch or further their appeals, this is relatively good news that just because a guy is innocent, he won't automatically be shut out of appeals, because that's very much been a problem in a lot of cases around the country with death row inmates. DNA evidence and the emergence of DNA evidence has suggested that there are an awful lot of people in death rows around various parts of the country who might in fact be innocent and who receive poor representation in their cases, and this could help an awful lot of people.
All right. And a judge in Brooklyn.
Yeah, this was not Supreme Court, but it was the case that we've talked about on this program a couple of times in the past, where it was a class action suit involving Muslims who were rounded up in the days after 9/11 by the federal government, and they also are suing specifically pursuant to the cases of a handful of people who are claiming abuse and harsh conditions when they were held in confinement. That part of the case, the abuse and harsh conditions, is still alive, but the federal judge throughout the part of the case that claimed that people were rounded up illegally just because they were Muslim. He ruled that, and this is almost a direct quote, that the government has wide latitude under immigration law to detain non-citizens on the basis of religion, race, or national origin, and to hold them indefinitely without explanation. That's a very scary kind of ruling. The judge, John Gleason, the United States District Court for the 8th District of New York, did allow the lawsuit to continue on other claims, mostly that the conditions of confinement were abusive and unconstitutional. And then one other court development on Wednesday, that the ACLU nationally, including a number of state ACLUs, and that includes the ACLU of Washington State, have sued the Department of Defense to get their files, information that the Pentagon has accumulated on peace groups that they have monitored around the country, including, as we've talked about on this program a number of time, groups here in the Seattle area, Ground Zero Center for Nonviolent Action being prominent among them.
All right. So I guess we'll wait to hear on that one, huh?
Yeah. we'll see how that goes.
All right. And GAO came out with a report this week?
Yeah, it did. And it doesn't look very good. The GAO, which is the sort of independent watchdog agency that audits Congress and tallies up costs of different things, reports this week that the federal government spent $1.4 billion, that's with a B, billion dollars on fraudulent or inappropriate claims in the wake of Katrina and Hurricanes Katrina and Rita last summer. So an awful lot of fraud and waste built into the system there. And of course, as we've also talked about on this program, an awful lot of no-bid contracts and sort of questionable accounting going into the reconstruction efforts as well. So that is an ongoing issue with a lot of the things that are happening in New Orleans and the Mississippi coast, even as we speak.
Yeah. All right. And Karl Rove looks like he's off the hook for a while.
Yeah, legally anyway. You know, once he goes to meet his maker, he might have a few things to answer for. But Patrick Fitzgerald announcing, I believe it was on Monday, that he is not at this time going to seek an indictment. Actually, I think it was the White House that announced it against Karl Rove. This in spite of Jason Leopold's story about a month ago, which he is standing by, that the grand jury did return an indictment and it's under seal in Washington, D.C., according to Leopold, it's under sealed versus sealed. The secrecy surrounding it is so high, but that can stay there, you know, pretty much indefinitely. And it may be that even though the grand jury returned the indictment, Fitzgerald decided not to pursue it because he didn't feel he could win in court. Whatever the case is, an awful lot of the media coverage around this used language similar to the Bush administration, that Rove had been quote unquote exonerated. That's not exactly accurate. For one thing, Rove had been claiming when this case was developing that he had nothing to do with the leaking of Valerie Plame's covert status and identity. We now know that not to be true, that he was up to his neck in it. We also know for a fact that he was involved in an effort that was orchestrated right up to and including President Bush to smear and discredit Ambassador Joe Wilson and obviously his wife because of Wilson's role in publicly questioning the rationales for the U.S. invasion of Iraq. You know, we know that that was a concerted effort on behalf of the White House. So Rove does not come out of this smelling ethically or morally sweet, but it does look like he's going to avoid jail or a trial. And, you know, that's unfortunate from a standpoint of accountability. But there's still certainly an awful lot of other crimes that the Bush administration has to be held accountable for as well. You know, just keep plugging away and, you know, hoping that the Justice Department and the courts can and Congress can find some spine somewhere and catch up with some of them.
All right. Jumping into international, obviously a lot happening this week in Iraq.
Yeah. A whole lot going on. We'll start with quite possibly the least consequential, which was the debate in Congress, and particularly the House, over a resolution that was completely politically motivated. It was a resolution pursued by the Republicans, and, you know, replete with mentions of victory and democracy and yada yada yada, basically for the purpose of getting Democrats on the record as opposing the resolution, so in the 2006 elections they can go and see Democrats voted against the troops, which is, you know, kind of ironic since every poll that's out there nationally shows that at least 60% of the American population, and usually the polls are a little bit higher than that, support withdrawal of troops from Iraq either immediately or in the very near future. So, you know, the Republicans are kind of going against the grain here, but they don't seem to think so. But that dominated the news this week, and it was the timing was not particularly accidental because there were a number of other things about Iraq that should have been in the news but were not because of this kind of bogus and irrelevant debate. One of them being that Congress approved $65.8 billion in new money to fight the war in Iraq because they're running out. This is an emergency appropriation through the month of September. There is another separate bill still in Congress working its way through for another $50 billion for the war in Iraq that's supposed to fund it for September of this year through March of 2007, and that probably won't be enough for the six-month period. You know, that between those two bills, it's well over $100 billion for less than a year. And, you know, once again, we go back to the 2004 presidential election where John Kerry got a whole lot of grief for saying that the war in Iraq cost $200 billion. You know, we should be so lucky if it cost that little. While those bills were going through, U.S. troop deaths in Iraq reached 2,500. Curiously enough, that got an awful lot less attention than when we reached the previous major milestone of 2,000 dead. And part of it was because Congress was in the middle of this debate. Another probably much more significant figure that came out this week, the U.S. Committee for Refugees and Immigrants released a report saying that the global population of refugees in the year 2005 increased to 12 million people, and almost all of that increase came from the massive increase in number of refugees from Iraq, specifically 644,500 new refugees was their estimate in Iraq, most of them going to Jordan and Syria, and those numbers increasing even from 2005 in the first months of 2006, indicating, quote, a more significant outflow of refugees from Iraq in 2006 and into the future. Now, you know, we're talking about, 600,000 destroyed lives of Iraqis in 2005 alone, and you know, many more coming this year, that getting virtually no attention, while a few extra deaths of soldiers in the U.S. Making it 2,500 total, got what headlines there were gotten. It tells you a lot about how we value the lives of U.S. soldiers versus Iraqi civilians. Also on that front, a report by Dar Jamal, an independent journalist who we've cited a number of times and who's been interviewed on this program. He has a report out that the U.S. military is creating a new Fallujah in the city of Ramadi, which is the capital of Anbar province. And this actually has been coming for some time, Ramadi being, the capital of the province, which has the largest Sunni population and the most concerted insurgent forces anywhere in the country. And according to Jamal, electricity, food, water, and medical supplies have been cut off for the last 2 months, which is very consistent with how they've treated Fallujah and other cities where they've laid siege in the past. Bombings, including random bombings, have increased in recent days. The U.S. snipers are just sort of randomly shooting people from rooftops. And the situation is being called catastrophic by people who are able to find their way out of the city. At the same time, the U.S. Military has imposed a complete media blackout. They're not even allowing embedded reporters anywhere near Ramadi. So nobody's quite sure what's happening there, but it looks like it's really grim. Keep an eye on this one, because it could turn into the next disaster. And this also is consistent with what happens every time Iraq forms a new government. It seems like the new prime minister or the new parliament or whomever has to prove their mettle by giving the sign off on the or we have to show support for the new government by going in and massacring a bunch of people, and that looks like it may well be what is happening here. And then finally, we had a report this week in the UK Telegraph newspaper over in Britain, which didn't get quite as much play here in the U.S., that the Pentagon is developing a plan to keep 50,000 troops in Iraq permanently. That actually is about one-tenth of the total overseas deployment of U.S. troops on a permanent basis. And, of course, this comes at the same time that the White House is insisting that we have no plans for a permanent U.S. presence in Iraq, even though we're building massive bases and a huge U.S. embassy complex in Baghdad. Now report that the U.S. plans to keep 50,000 troops there indefinitely. Not at all a good sign. And again, something that Congress has been asking about, the American public has been asking about, and we're getting stonewalled on by the Bush administration.
50,000 also being the number of private security forces that is the estimate for Iraq.
Yeah, and you also wonder in terms of long range plans, how much privatization we're planning to do. Not just using proxy armies, as we have certainly done in the past. We have a long history of that, but actually contracting out to private U.S. firms, work that has historically been done by the U.S. military with at least somewhat greater accountability than we have over these private firms.
Yeah, well, and actually there'll be some more detail on that tomorrow morning at 7 when we play a talk by Greg Palast, last week.
So. Good.
All right, moving along. Palestine-Israel, plenty happening there this week as well.
Yeah, we talked last week briefly about the referendum that the Fatah leader, Mahmoud Abbas, wants to put forward in late July. That almost entirely at this point is a Fatah referendum. The members of Hamas and Islamic Jihad, who had signed on to it in the past, have now disavowed their signatures, and Hamas is bitterly opposed to it. They're in negotiations now, and you know this once again is pointing to the very real danger of a major split in the government of the Palestine Authority, which Israel has to love, and which the United States and Israel are in many ways helping to. Helping to create. At the same time, there was a sort of escalation in the siege that Israel and the U.S. have laid West Bank and especially Gaza to this week, around an incident in which 8 Palestinian civilians were killed on a beach by, depending on who you listen to, either Israeli shelling or unexploded ordnance on the beach, those being the explanations of the Palestine Authority and Israel, respectively. Israel had been shelling that area of the Gaza pretty heavily all day. They claimed that they had stopped their shelling about a half hour before the explosion happened on the beach. Nonetheless, that was the trigger for Hamas to unilaterally break its unilaterally declared 16-month ceasefire. They then came back to Israel later in the week, a couple of days ago, with a proposal that that they and Israel enter into a ceasefire, and that they would declare a ceasefire once again if Israel ceased military activity within the West Bank and Gaza. And of course, Israel has said they won't do that. So there we are once again. We also had in Somalia. This is something that actually happened late last week, but. We didn't get a chance to talk about it last week, and the media coverage on it in the U.S. really was not very good. Mogadishu was overrun by and the warlords controlling Mogadishu were ousted by an incoming army, and so Somalia now has a government for the first time in 15 years. Unfortunately, and this is something that was not clear from the media coverage here in this country, the government is basically run by Sharia law Islamists at this point. And so you have Islamists and what some people are calling a new Taliban controlling a country on the Horn of Africa. Just geopolitically, it's kind of a disaster for U.S. foreign policy and U.S. interests in the region. And, raises once again the CIA had been supporting the warlords that were controlling Mogadishu just because, you know, they were doing it in exchange for trying to get a hold of al-Qaeda terrorists. And there's a lot of recriminations going on in Washington right now of, you know, the Bush administration, once again, not really understanding local conditions, not really knowing what they were doing in Somalia, in Africa, in the Islamic world. What's new?
A couple studies out this week. One, a survey from the Pew people.
Yeah, the Pew Global Attitudes Project does a survey every year of global attitudes, and included in that survey every year are questions regarding how people view the U.S. And what they came up with for 2005 was that attitudes toward the United States, toward the leadership of George Bush, toward whether the United States poses a greater threat to world peace than or the United States war in Iraq. Iraq poses a greater threat to world peace than the acquisition of nuclear weapons by Iran, and what their view of the war in Iraq is, all show attitudes toward the U.S. Among Europeans and among Islamic countries to be at an all-time low. Now they had reached they plummeted and reached an all-time low after the invasion of Iraq in 2003, but actually for the couple of years thereafter, the attitudes had slowly improved a little bit, just because they were so bad in 2003. The number of people who had a favorable view of the United States in Jordan, for example, in 2003 was 1%. It's a little bit better than that now, but not much. And the same is true in a lot of the rest of the world, that particularly with the developments in Iraq, the view of the U.S. Really was what it has been in decline. And this, of course, if you're pursuing a global war on terrorism, it's not so much about military conquest. It's about changing people's attitudes and getting them to not support the actions of people who want to who want to harm the U.S. in particular and Western societies in general. And we are losing that war by the actions of the Bush administration, and we are less safe now than we were then. And this is exactly the sort of measure that shows that problem. We also had a study that came out this week from the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute showing the cost of world military spending, that world military spending was up 3.5% in 2005 to a total of $1.12 trillion for the year. And the United States had 48% of total global military spending in 2005. Now, by comparison, the next highest country was our erstwhile ally, the Brits, the United Kingdom, at slightly under 5% of world military spending. And there were several other countries, most of them with the exception of China and Russia, also U.S. allies, that were between 4 and 5%. The United States accounted for 80% of the increase in 2005, and most of the rest of the increase, interestingly enough, came from countries like Saudi Arabia that were benefiting from increased oil prices and had some extra money to burn. Those countries, of course, were benefiting from oil prices that were driven up in large part by the actions of the United States through things like invading Iraq and threatening Iran. And not only that, but they were, by and large, buying weapons from the United States. So almost all of the increase in military spending in the world in 2005, either directly or indirectly, came through the United States.
All right. And finally, briefly, Guantanamo.
Three suicides at Guantanamo Bay last weekend. And the Bush administration spin of it, first of all, was horrifying. The prison commander called the suicides, quote, asymmetrical warfare, a flak of the Bush administration being interviewed by the BBC, said, quote, they don't value their own lives. It certainly is a good PR move, however. And much of the media coverage in this country followed suit. It was all along the line of how dare they, rather than examining why people would have been so desperate as to, particularly how dare they actually conceal their actions, rather than how anybody could be in conditions where they were detained for 4 years with the prospect of being detained indefinitely, for the rest of their lives in horrible conditions, not knowing why they were there, not having any recourse to due process, not having any opportunity to contact the outside world or be contacted by the outside world. It's surprising this hasn't happened before. But the attitude toward it, particularly not just the Bush administration, but you should expect, but the media, shows you what happens with year after year after year of this kind of war torture and warfare and military spending. That's what happens to the attitudes of a country. That's what it does to poison us as well as our victims overseas.
All right. And finally, events.
Yeah. The one thing I wanted to mention, because it might involve some travel plans for people who are interested, is that not this weekend, but next weekend in Vancouver, BC, we're having for several days the Global Peace Forum, the Vancouver Global Peace Forum, where peace activists, anti-war agitators from all over the world, including some really pretty amazing resources and high-level figures, will be coming to give talks and workshops and strategize. So that'll be in Vancouver, BC next weekend, and you can find it on the web under Vancouver Peace Forum.
Very good. Well, as we do every week, talking with Jav Parrish, co-editor at Eat the State. And where do people find Eat the State?
Eat the State comes out every couple of weeks. It is a free publication newspaper that a bunch of us volunteer types put out. You can find it and a lot of the same kind of content that you hear on this show, only in more detail, of course. You can find it anywhere you find free publications, bookstores, cafes, King County Library System, all kinds of places like that. You can also find it on the web. Our current issue and all of our past issues are at www.eatthestate.org. As we mentioned before, our blog has been down for the past 3 weeks due to ISP and server problems. It is back up now under a new server, and we are in the process of restoring it and should start having new entries in the next couple of days. So look forward to that. And we'll be hanging around Fremont Fair this week, weekend. So look for us there.
All right. You'll be at a table there.
I'm not sure not yet sure. Whether we'll have a table or whether we'll just be handing out papers.
There.
But yeah, we'll be around.
All right.
Just look for the goofy people being chased off by security. Okay.